Map-making had never been a precise art on the Discworld. People tended to start off with good intentions and then get so carried away with the spouting whales, monsters, waves, and other twiddly bits of cartographic furniture that they often forgot to put the boring mountains and rivers in at all. The Arch-Chancellor put an overflowing ashtray on a corner that threatened to roll up. He dragged a finger across the grubby surface.
"Says here, here be dragons," he said. "Right inside the city, too. Odd, that."
"That's just Lady Ramkin's sunshine sanctuary for sick dragons," said the bursar distractedly.
"And here there's Terra Incognita," said the Arch-Chancellor. "Why's that?"
The bursar craned to see.
"Well, it is probably more interesting than putting in lots of cabbage farms."
"And there's here been dragons again."
I think that's just a lie, in fact."
The Arch-Chancellor's horny thumb continued in the direction they'd worked out. He brushed aside a couple of fly specks.
"Nothing here at all," he said, peering closer. "Just the sea and," he squinted, "the holy wood. Mean anything?"
"Isn't that where the alchemists all went?" said the bursar.
"Oh, them.
I suppose," said the bursar slowly, "they wouldn't be doing some kind of magic out there."
"Alchemists doing magic?"
Sorry, ridiculous idea, I know. The porter told me they do some sort of shadow play or something, or puppets, or something similar. Pictures, or something. I wasn't really paying attention. I mean, alchemists, really. I mean, assassins, yes. Thieves, yes. Even merchants. Merchants can be really devious sometimes, but alchemists... Show me a more unworldly, bumbling, well-meaning..."
His voice trailed off as his ears caught up with his mouth.
"They wouldn't dare, would they?" he said.
"Would they?"
The bursar gave a hollow laugh.
"No, they wouldn't dare. They know we'd be down on them like a ton of bricks if they tried any magic round here."
His voice trailed off again.
"I'm sure they wouldn't," he said. "I mean, even that far away," he said. "They wouldn't dare," he said. "Not magic, surely not," he said. "I've never trusted those grubby-handed bastards," he said. "They're not like us, you know. They've got no idea of proper dignity."
The crowd surging around the box office was getting deeper and more angry by the minute.
"Well, have you gone through all your pockets?" demanded the chair.
"Yes,"
muttered the dean.
"Have another look, then."
As far as wizards were concerned, paying to get into anything was something that happened to other people. A pointy hat usually did nicely. While the dean struggled, the chair beamed madly at the young woman who was selling tickets.
"But I assure you, dear lady," he said desperately, "we are wizards."
"I can see your false beards," said the girl, and sniffed. "We get all sorts in here. How do I know you aren't three little boys in your dad's coat?"
"Madam."
"I've got $2.15, said the dean, picking the coins out of a handful of fluff and mysterious occult objects.
"That's two in the stalls, then," said the girl, grudgingly unreeling two tickets. The chair scooped them up.
"Then I'll take Windolin," he said quickly, turning to the others. "I'm afraid the rest of you'd better get back to your honest trading."
He moved his eyebrows up and down suggestively.
"I don't see why we should," the dean began. "Otherwise we'll be in arrears,"
the chair went on, mugging furiously,
"if you don't get back."
"See here, that was my money," and the dean said, but the lecturer in recent runes grabbed his arm.
"Just come along," he said, winked slowly and deliberately at the chair. "Time we were getting back."
"I don't see why," the dean gurgled as they dragged him off. Grey clouds swirled in the Arch-Chancellor's magic mirror. Many wizards had them, but not many had ever bothered to use them. They were quirky and unreliable. They weren't even much good for shaving in. Ridcully was surprisingly adept at using one.
"Stalking,"
he offered as a brief explanation.
couldn't be having with all that crawling around in damp bracken for hours, begods. Help yourself to a drink, man, and one for me. The clouds flickered. Can't seem to see anything else, he said. Odd that. Just fog flashing away. The Arch-Chancellor coughed. It was beginning to dawn on the bursar that against all expectation the Arch-Chancellor was quite bright. "Ever seen one of these shadow-moving puppet-play picture things?" Ridcully said.
"The servants go," said the bursar.
This, Ridcully decided, meant no.
"I think we should have a look," he said. "Very well, Arch-Chancellor," said the bursar meekly.
An inviolable rule about buildings for the showing of moving pictures, applicable throughout the multiverse, is that the ghastliness of the architecture around the back is universally proportional to the gloriousness of the architecture in the front. At the front, pillars, arches, gold leaf, lights. At the back, weird ducts, mysterious prolapses of pipework, blank walls, fetid alleys, and the window to the lavatories. "There's no reason at all why we should have to do this," moaned the Dean as the wizard struggled in the darkness. "Shut up and keep pushing," muttered the lecturer in recent runes from the other side of the window. "We could have changed something into money," said the Dean. "Just a quick illusion. What's the harm in that?" "It's called watering the currency," said the lecturer in recent runes. "You can get thrown into the scorpion pit for stuff like that. Where am I putting my feet? Where am I putting my feet?"
"You're fine," said a wizard. "Right, Dean, up you come."
"Oh, dear," moaned the Dean as he was dragged through the narrow window into the unmentionable gloom beyond. "No good will come of this. Just watch where you're putting your feet. Now see what you've done. Didn't I tell you to watch where you're putting your feet? Anyway, come on." The wizard skulked, or in the Dean's case, squelched furtively through the backstage area and into the darkened, bustling auditorium, where Wendell Poons was keeping some seats free by the simple expedient of waving his stick at anyone who came near them. They sidled in, tripping over one another's legs, and sat down. They stared at the shadowy grey rectangle at the other end of the hall. After a while, the chair said,
"Can't see what people see in it, myself."
"Has anyone done deformed rabbit?" said the lecturer in recent runes.
"It hasn't started yet," hissed the Dean.
I'm hungry," complained Poons. "I'm an old man, and I'm hungry."
"Do you know what he did?" said the Chair. "Do you know what the old fool did? When a young lady with a torch was showing us to our seats, he pinched her on the fundament."
Poons sniggered.
"Hubba, hubba! Does your mother know you're out?" he cackled.
"It's all too much for him," the Chair complained. "We never should have brought him."
"Do you realize we're missing our dinner?" said the Dean. The wizards fell silent at this. A stout woman, edging in past Poons's wheelchair, suddenly started and looked round suspiciously and saw nothing except a dear old man, obviously fast asleep.
"And it's goose on Tuesdays," said the Dean.
Poons opened one eye and honked the horn of his wheelchair.
"Chentera, Bobs! How's your granny off for soap?"
he muttered triumphantly.
"See what I mean?" said the Chair. "He doesn't know what century it is."
Poons turned a beady black eye on him.
Old I am, and daft I may be," he said, "but I ain't going to be hungry."
He rummaged around in the unspeakable depths of the wheelchair and produced a greasy black bag. It jingled.
"I saw a young lady up the front a selling of special moving picture food," he said.
"You mean you had money all the time?" said the Dean, "and you never told us?"
"You never asked," said Poons.
The wizards stared hungrily at the bag.
"They be having buttered banged grains and sausages in buns and chocolate things with things on and things," said Poons.
He gave them a toothless and crafty look.
"You can have some, too, if you like," he added graciously.
The Dean ticked off his purchases.
Now, he said, that's 6 patrician-sized tubs of banged grains with extra butter, 8 sausages in a bun, a jumbo cup of fizzy drink, and a bag of chocolate-covered raisins. He handed over the money.
Right,
said the chair, gathering up the containers.
Do you think we should get something for the others?
In the picture-throwing room, Bizam cursed as he threaded the huge reel of blown away into the picture-throwing box. A few feet away, in a roped-off section of the balcony, the patrician of Ankh-Morpork, Lord Vetinari, was also ill at ease. They were, he had to admit, a pleasant enough young couple. He just wasn't sure why he was sitting next to them, and why they were so important. He was used to important people, or at least to people who thought they were important. Wizards became important through high deeds of magic. Thieves became important for daring robberies, and so in a slightly different way did merchants. Warriors became important through winning battles and staying alive. Assassins became important through skillful inhumations. There were many roads to prominence, but you could see them. You could work them out. They made some sort of sense. Whereas these two people had merely moved interestingly in front of this newfangled moving picture machinery. The rankest actor in the city's theatre was a multi-skilled master of thespianism by comparison to them, but it wouldn't occur to anyone to line the streets and shout out his name. The patrician had never visited the cliques before. As far as he could ascertain, Victor Maraschino was famous for a sort of smouldering look that had middle-aged ladies who should know better swooning in the aisles. And Mr. Sin's forte was acting languidly, slapping faces, and looking fantastic while lying among silken cushions. While he, patrician of Ankh-Morpork, ruled the city, preserved the city, loved the city, hated the city, and spent half a lifetime in the service of the city. And as the common people had been filing into the stalls, his razor-keen hearing had picked up the conversation of two of them.
"Who's that up there?"
"That's Victor Maraschino and Dolores de Sin. Do you know nothing?"
"I mean the tall guy in black."
"Huh?
Dunno who he is. Just some bigwig, I expect."
Yes, it was fascinating. You could become famous just for being, well, famous. It occurred to him that this was an extremely dangerous thing, and he might probably have to have someone killed one day, although it would be with reluctance. On his part, that is. Their reluctance probably goes without saying. In the meantime, there was a kind of secondary glory that came from being in the company of the truly celebrated, and to his astonishment he was enjoying it. Besides, he was also sitting next to Miss de Sin, and the envy of the rest of the audience was so palpable he could taste it, which was more than he could do with a bag full of fluffy white starchy things he'd been given to eat. On his other side, the horrible Dibbler man was explaining the mechanics of moving pictures in the utterly mistaken belief that the patrician was listening to a word of it. There was a sudden roar of applause. The patrician leaned sideways to Dibbler.
Why are all the lamps being turned down? He said.
Ah, sir, said Dibbler, that is so you can see the pictures better.
Is it? One would imagine it would make the pictures harder to see, said the patrician.
It's not like that with moving pictures, sir, said Dibbler.
How very fascinating.
The patrician leaned the other way to Ginger and Victor. To his mild surprise, they were looking extremely tense. He'd noticed that as soon as they had walked into the odium. The boy looked at all the ridiculous ornamentation as if it was something dreadful, and when the girl had stepped into the pit proper, he'd heard her gasp. They looked as though they were in shock.
I expect this is all perfectly commonplace to you, he said.
No, said Victor, not really. We've never been in a proper picture pit before.
Except once, said Ginger grimly.
Yes, except once.
But, ha, you make moving pictures, said the patrician kindly.
Yes, but we never see them. We just see bits of them, when the handlemen are gluing it all together. The only clicks I've ever seen were on an old sheet outdoors, said Victor.
So, this is all new to you, said the patrician.
Not exactly, said Victor, grey-faced.
Fascinating, said the patrician,
and went back to not listening to Dibbler. He had not got where he was today by bothering how things worked. It was how people worked that intrigued him. Further along the rows, Sol leaned across to his uncle and dropped a small coil of film in his lap.
This belongs to you, he said sweetly.
"What is it?"
said Dibbler. "Well, I thought I'd have a quick look at the click before it got shown."
"You did?"
said Dibbler. "And what did I find in the middle of the burning city scene but 5 minutes showing nothing but a plate of spare ribs in Harger's special peanut sauce? I know why, of course. I just want to know why this." Dibbler grinned guiltily.
"The way I see it," he said, "if one little quick picture can make people want to go and buy things, just think what 5 minutes' worth could do."
Sol stared at him.
"I'm really hurt by this," said Dibbler. "You didn't trust me, your own uncle. After I gave you my solemn promise not to try anything again, you didn't trust me. That wounds me, Sol. I'm really wounded. Whatever happened to integrity round here?"
"I think you've probably sold it to someone, Uncle."
"I'm really hurt," said Dibbler.
"But you didn't keep your promise, Uncle."
"That's got nothing to do with it. That's just business. We're talking family here. You've got to learn to trust family, Sol. Especially me."
Sol shrugged. "Okay, okay.
Right?"
"Yes, Uncle," Sol grinned. "You've got my solemn promise on that."
"That's my boy."
At the other end of the row, Victor and Ginger were staring at the blank screen in sullen horror.
"You know what's going to happen now, don't you?" said Ginger.
"Yes, someone's going to start playing music out of a hole in the floor."
"Was that cave really a picture pit?"
"Sort of, I think," said Victor carefully.
"But the screen here is just a screen. It's not... well, it's just a screen. Just a better class of sheet. It's not..."
There was a blast of sound from the front of the hall. With a clanking and the hiss of desperately escaping air, Bizam's daughter Calliope rose slowly out of the floor, attacking the keys on a small pipe with all the verve of several hours' practice and the combined efforts of 2 strong trolls working the bellows behind the scenes. She was a beefy young woman, and whatever piece of music she was playing, it was definitely losing. Down in the stalls, the Dean passed a bag along to the chair.
"Have a chocolate-covered raisin," he said.
"They look like rat droppings," said the chair.
The Dean peered at them in the gloom.
"So that's it," he said. "The bag fell on the floor a minute ago, and I thought there seemed rather a lot."
"Shh,"
said a woman in the row behind. Windle Poons's scrawny head turned like a magnet.
"Hoochie coochie," he cackled. 2 pence more and up goes the donkey."
The lights went down further, the screen flickered, numbers appeared and blinked briefly, counting down. Calliope peered intently at the score in front of her, rolled up her sleeves, pushed her hair out of her eyes, and launched a spirited attack on what was just discernible as the old Ankh-Morpokian civic anthem. "We can rule you wholesale." The lights went out. The sky flickered. It wasn't like a proper fog at all. It shed a silvery, slaty light, flickering internally like a cross between the aurora coriolis and summer lightning. In the direction of Holywood, the sky blazed with light. It was visible even in the alley behind Sham Harger's House of Ribs, where 2 dogs were enjoying the all-you-can-drag-out-of-the-midden-for-free special. Laddie looked up and growled.
"I don't blame you," said Gaspard. "I said it boded. Didn't I say there was boding happening?"
Sparks crackled off his fur.
"Come on," he said. "We better warn people. You're good at that."
Click, 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 click. It was the only noise inside the Odeum. Calliope had stopped playing and was staring up at the screen. Mouths hung open and closed only to bite on handfuls of banged grains. Victor was dimly aware that he'd fought it. He tried to look away. Even now, a little voice in his own head was telling him that things were wrong, but he ignored it. Things were clearly right. He'd shared in the sighs as the heroine tried to preserve the old family mine in a world gone mad. He'd shuddered at the fighting in the war. He'd watched the ballroom scene in a romantic haze. He was aware of a cold sensation against his leg. It was as though a half-melted ice cube was soaking through his trousers. He tried to ignore it, but it had a definite, unignorable quality. He looked down.
"Excuse me," said Gaspard.
Victor's eyes focused, then his eyes found themselves being dragged back to the screen, where a huge version of himself was kissing a huge version of Ginger. There was another feeling of sticky coldness. He surfaced again.
I can bite your leg if you like, said Gaspode.
Victor began.
I can bite it quite hard, Gaspode added. Just say the word.
No, something's boding, just like I said. Bode, bode, bode.
Laddie's tried barking until he's hoarse, but no one's listening. So I thought I'd try the old cold nose technique. Never fails.
Victor looked around him. The rest of the audience were staring at the screen as if they were prepared to remain in their seats for... forever. When he lifted his arms up from the seat, sparks crackled from his fingers, and there was a greasy feel to the air that even student wizards soon learned to associate with a vast accumulation of magical potential. And there was fog in the pit. It was ridiculous, but there it was, covering the floor like a pale silver tide. He shook Ginger's shoulder. He waved a hand in front of her eyes. He shouted in her ear. Then he tried the patrician, and Dibbler. They yielded to pressure, but swayed gently back into position again.
The film's doing something to them, he said. It must be the film, but I can't see how. It's a perfectly ordinary film. We don't use magic in Holywood, at least not normal magic.
He struggled over unyielding knees until he reached the aisle and ran up it through the tendrils of fog. He hammered on the door of the picture-throwing room. When that got no answer, he kicked it down. Beezam was staring intently at the screen through a small square hole cut in the wall. The picture-thrower was clicking away happily by itself. No one was turning the handle. At least, Victor corrected himself, no one he could see. There was a distant rumble and the ground shook. He stared at the screen. He recognised this bit. It was just before the burning of Ankh-Morpork scene. His mind raced. What was it they said about the gods? They wouldn't exist if there weren't people to believe in them. And that applied to everything. Reality was what went on inside people's heads. And in front of him were hundreds of people really believing what they were seeing. Victor scrabbled among the rubbish on Beezam's bench for some scissors or a knife, and found neither. The machine whirred on, winding reality from the future to the past. In the background he could hear Gaspode saying,
"I expect I've saved the day, right?"
The brain normally echoes with the shouts of various inconsequential thoughts seeking attention. It takes a real emergency to get them to shut up. It was happening now. One clear thought that had been trying to make itself heard for a long time ran out in the silence. Supposing there was somewhere where reality was a little thinner than usual, and supposing you did something there that weakened reality even more. Books wouldn't do it, even ordinary theatre wouldn't do it, because in your heart you know it was just people in funny clothes on a stage. But Holywood went straight from the eye into the brain. In your heart, you thought it was real. The cliques would do it. That was what was under Holywood Hill. The people of the old city had used the hole in reality for entertainment. And then the things had found them. And now people were doing it again. It was like learning to juggle lighted torches in a firework factory, and the things had been waiting. But why was it still happening? He'd stopped Ginger. The film clicked on. There seemed to be a fog around the picture-throwing box, blurring its outline. He snatched at the spinning handle. It resisted for a moment and then broke. He gently pushed Beezam off his chair, picked it up, and hit the throwing box with it. The chair exploded into splinters. He opened the cage at the back and took out the salamanders, and still the film danced on the distant screen. The building shook again. You only get one chance, he thought, and then you die. He pulled off his shirt and wrapped it around his hand. Then he reached out for the flashing line of the film itself and gripped it. It snapped. The box jerked backwards, film went on unreeling in glittering coils which lunged at him briefly and then slithered down to the floor. Click, 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 click. The reels spun to a halt. Victor cautiously stirred the heap of film with his foot. He'd been half expecting it to attack him like a snake.
"Have we saved the day?" prompted Gaspode. "I'd appreciate knowing."
Victor looked at the screen.
"No," he said. There were still images there. They weren't very clear, but he could still make out the vague shapes of himself and Ginger hanging on to existence. And the screen itself was moving. It bulged here and there like ripples of a pool of dull mercury. It looked unpleasantly familiar.
"They found us," he said.
"Who have?" said Gaspode. "You know those ghastly creatures you were talking about?"
Gaspode's brow furrowed.
"The ones from before the dawn of time?"
"Where they come from, there is no time," said Victor. The audience was stirring. "We must get everyone out of here," he said, "but without panicking." There was a chorus of screams. The audience was waking up. The screen ginger was climbing out. She was 3 times normal size and flickered visibly. She was also vaguely transparent, but she had weight because the floor buckled and splintered under her feet. The audience was climbing over itself to get away. Victor fought his way down the aisle just as Poons's wheelchair went past backwards in the flow of people, its occupant flailing desperately and shouting,
"Hey! Hey! It's just getting good!"
The chair grabbed Victor's arm urgently.
"Is it meant to do this?"
he demanded.
"No! It's not some sort of special kinematographic effect, then?"
said the chair, hopefully. "Not unless they've got really good in the last 24 hours, said Victor. "I think it's the dungeon dimensions." The chair stared intently at him.
"You are young Victor, aren't you?"
he said. "Yes, excuse me," said Victor. He pushed past the astonished wizard and climbed over the seats to where Ginger was still sitting, staring at her own image. The monster Ginger was looking around and blinking very slowly like a lizard.
"That's me?"
"No," said Victor. "That is, yes, maybe, not really, sort of. Come on."
"But it looks just like me,"
said Ginger, her voice modulated with hysteria. "That's because they're having to use holy wood. It defines how they can appear, I think," said Victor hurriedly. He tugged her out of the seat and into the air, his feet kicking up mist and scattering banged grains. She stumbled along after him, looking over her shoulder.
"There's another one trying to come out of the screen," she said.
"Come on!
It's you.
I'm me. It's something else. It's just having to use my shape."
"What shape does it normally use?"
"You don't want to know."
"Yes, I do. Why do you think I asked?"
she yelled as they stumbled through the broken seats.
"It looks worse than you can imagine."
"I can imagine some pretty bad things."
"That's why I said worse."
"Oh."
The giant spectral ginger passed them, flickering like a strobe light, and smashed its way out through the wall. There were screams from the outside.
"It looks as though it's getting bigger,"
whispered Ginger. "Go outside," said Victor. "Get the wizards to stop it."
"What are you going to do?"
Victor drew himself up to his full height.
"There are some things," he said, "that a man has to do by himself."
She gave him a look of irritated incomprehension.
"What? What? Do you want to go to the lavatory or something? Just get out."
He shoved her towards the doors, then turned and saw the 2 dogs looking at him expectantly.
"And you two, too," he said.
Laddie barked. "Dog's got to stay by his master style of thing," said Gaspard shamefacedly.
Victor looked around in desperation, picked up a fragment of seat, opened the door, threw the wood as far as possible, and shouted, "Fetch!" Both dogs bounded away after it, propelled by instinct. On his way past, though, Gaspard just had enough self-control to say, "You bastard!"